Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Dr. Messner, please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Kristen. I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care workshop. Well, actually, this program is being done in collaboration with the CLL Society, Inc. And I really want to thank them for their collaboration with us today. Today's program is part one of Life with Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia, or CLL, and there are four parts to this program. And today's program is supported by AbbVie, a contribution from Lilly, and an educational grant from Johnson & Johnson Healthcare Systems. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program. And today's program is really a very interesting one in the sense that we have so many participants on the call today. We have over 300 participants on this program today, and you come from all over the world. First of all, from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from South Africa, Canada, Germany, Belgium, Australia, Brazil, Ethiopia, Canada, Israel, and Australia. So really quite a global call today as well. And it's really a pleasure to have all of you on the call today. And I would like to comment on the fact that just there are so many of you on the program today. It's really a credit to the our collaboration with the CLL Society, and we're delighted to have so many of you on the call today. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Masio Shadman, and Dr. Shadman is Associate Professor, Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, Associate Professor, Medical Oncology Division, University of Washington, Associate Professor, Attending Physician, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And Dr. Shadman will be addressing an overview of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, current treatment options, and new perspectives and emerging treatment approaches. It's my pleasure now to introduce for all of you Dr. Masio Shadman. Dr. Shadman.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to our audience today. It's amazing to have 300 people online, and I'm looking forward to having a productive discussion in the form of Q&A at the end. And my task is to review the general aspects of CLL or SLL and kind of go through some of the standard of care treatment options for CLL and SLL. Before I start, I wanted to have a few points to make. So when I refer to this disease as CLL or chronic lymphocytic leukemia, everything I say also applies to SLL or small lymphocytic lymphoma. These are basically same diseases in terms of, you know, treatment options, indications for treatment, and therapeutic options that we discussed. But I may refer to it as CLL, but everything I say also refers to SLL. Definitely in the past 10 years, for those of us who have been involved in taking care of patients with CLL or doing research in this area, has been an amazing transition from using chemotherapy 10-plus years ago to not using chemotherapy for our patients. So you can see how things have changed and how much progression we've had in terms of coming up with new treatment options and strategies for our patients. So one of the things that when I first meet my patients with a new diagnosis, I tell them that this diagnosis should not change your plans for life in terms of, you know, anything that you've planned, like investments, you know, family plans, traveling, work-related decisions. And, you know, these days we're able to provide treatments that are compatible with pretty much anyone's lifestyle or kind of work details. So what I will do here, I will, as I said, I point out the standard of care options. We always want to encourage our patients to participate in clinical trials, but it's also important to know what's the standard of care. And in the second part of this discussion, my colleague and friend, Dr. Kitai, will go through some of the investigational and clinical trial options. I may point out a few during my talk, but the main research discussion will be done by Dr. Kitai. So CLL being the most common type of leukemia impacts in U.S. 200,000 people, and every year we have more than 20,000 new diagnoses. Most of the time the diagnosis is surprising. Patients have a blood test or they may have a type of imaging before an elective surgery and they get a call and they know they're informed about the diagnosis, which of course creates a lot of anxiety as a new lymphoma or leukemia diagnosis. One of the discussions we have at the time of diagnosis is kind of going through the fact that not every patient with a CLL diagnosis requires treatment immediately. In fact, we would only start and discuss treatment if we believe that CLL or SLL is causing problems for the patient. And I usually put that in three categories. If you think about CLL being a leukemia, leukemia means a blood cancer, and we want to make sure that the type of blood cells that we all need to be able to live normally are being made at the level that are considered normal. What does that mean? So if I have CLL and I have elevated number of white blood cells in my blood, as long as I have a normal hemoglobin or hematocrit, and that's an indicator of red cells, and as long as I have normal platelet counts, and as long as I have normal neutrophil count, it means that regardless of this diagnosis, my bone marrow, the blood factory, is able to make blood cells for me. So these patients, from the blood standpoint, don't require therapy. The other reason to start treatment is when patients have large lymph nodes or lymph nodes that are causing symptoms. And if that happens, then we discuss treatment. And that, when I refer to lymph nodes, that also includes the spleen and liver size. And the third category are general symptoms that patients may have, for example, fatigue, losing weight, and having different symptoms. So as long as patients don't have any of these problems, we just monitor them clinically. We see them a few times a year. We do blood tests, and we adjust the frequency of visits based on their numbers and their symptoms. And the reason for that is that so far we have not been able to show that the starting treatment at the time of diagnosis would benefit patients in terms of them living longer. And we have done that with our older drugs, like chemotherapy drugs and some of the new drugs. And so far the standard of care remains to be watch and wait a strategy for patients who don't have symptoms. I would just point out that there is a very important randomized clinical trial sponsored by the National Cancer Institute that is looking at patients with a CLL diagnosis or SLL diagnosis who are considered to have high-risk disease. And in that clinical trial, which is currently open in many sites in the U.S. and Canada, patients will be randomized to receive chemotherapy, CLL therapy with venetoclax and obinutuzumab early after diagnosis or waiting until later. And I wanted to point out this is probably one of the few trials that I wanted to mention during my presentation. So when I say high-risk CLL, what do I mean by that? Unlike some of the other types of cancers, when we talk about the staging at the time of diagnosis, we do have a staging system for CLL. It's called RIE or BINET, depending on which part of the world you live. But really what matters in CLL are the molecular and chromosome changes that cancer cells may have. And you've probably heard of FISH study or karyotype studies. These are the type of studies that look at the chromosome structure of the cancer cells. We also very commonly use genomic studies to also look for specific mutations within the cancer cells. IGHV is an important gene that we look for, and also genes like P53. I think the message here is that we are increasingly encouraging our patients to have that information available early at the time of diagnosis, because these days, if we go through that information and if we tell a patient that they have high-risk CLL by their molecular and chromosome characteristics, they may, in fact, be eligible for an important clinical trial for early intervention. But outside of the clinical trial, the standard of care is to watch these patients and wait until they have a reason to be treated. And again, I repeat that would be having low blood counts, red cells, meaning anemia, having low platelet count, having low neutrophil count. And neutrophil is another type of white blood cell that's important to protect us against infections. Or if they have large or symptomatic lymph nodes or spleen or liver, or if they have general symptoms that we are convinced that are related to CLL or SLL, and in that case, we offer treatment. Now, I told you already that we don't use chemotherapy, so I tell my patients that there's no chemotherapy in your future with this disease, because we have now access to targeted drugs. And these targeted drugs for patients who need their first line of therapy, in general, there are two big families, two big categories that we discuss. Number one, a group of drugs that belong to the family of BTK, or Bruton tyrosine kinase. This is an enzyme that we target in cancer cells, and right now we have a number of BTK inhibitors that we use in practice. The two ones that we prefer to use in patients with CLL are acalabrutinib, or the second drug being zanubrutinib. These two are what we call second-generation BTK inhibitors. The other drug is ibrutinib, which was the first-in-class BTK inhibitor that we had access to. If we have access to acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib, these days we prefer those drugs because they have a better safety profile. The other category of treatment, so the important point to remember with BTK inhibitor therapy is that these treatments are designed to be given continuously and indefinitely until they stop working, or until patients have side effects that we have to stop treatment. Otherwise, think of them as a maintenance type therapy. It's like a medication that you would be taking for high blood pressure or diabetes. These treatments are designed to be given continuously. And there are some subgroups of diseases in terms of their molecular features that we may prefer using BTK inhibitors in, like in patients who have a mutated P53 gene, or if they have a deletion in chromosome 17p. So for some patients, those are preferred. For patients with those changes, the BTK inhibitor class may be preferred. Of course, when we talk about treatment, we should think about side effects. There is a long list of side effects with any drug, but the major categories that we think about are cardiovascular risks. For example, there is a slight increased risk of atrial fibrillation, that's irregular heartbeat. There is a slight increased risk for bleeding. But remember, many of our patients have, even with a history of atrial fibrillation, even taking blood thinners, they're still able to take these BTK inhibitors safely, and a large number of patients actually take concurrent blood thinners and get concurrent therapy for AFib. So having a history of AFib or being on a blood thinner is not a reason not to offer BTK inhibitors to the patients. Moving from this option number one to option number two. Option number two is a fixed duration therapy. So unlike the other group, here our plan or the strategy is to give patients treatment for 1 year and then stop treatment. To do that, we use two drugs in combination. One drug is venetoclax. It works differently from BTK inhibitors. It actually induces death in the cancer cells, which is a good thing. And we combine that with a monoclonal antibody, which is given as an infusional drug, and it's called obinutuzumab. So venetoclax and obinutuzumab would be a combination that we use in patients as a second option, and we give it for 1 year, and then we stop. And many patients, actually 6 years after stopping this kind of treatment, more than half of the patients remain to be disease-free, and they're not on treatment, which is amazing and really meaningful to many patients not to have to take a cancer drug. Now, this treatment requires some work at the beginning. The infusion is given on a weekly basis, basically for the first month, and the venetoclax pill has to be started at a low dose, and we slowly go up on the dose. So that may require a longer, like more frequent visits early on in the first couple of months. But then that's the price basically you're paying to be able to stop treatment at 1 year. So these two treatments are both very effective, and they work for a long time. For the second line, if patients stop treatment for toxicity reasons, or if treatment stops working, we can basically switch to the other class. So if we started with the BTK inhibitors, we can use venetoclax in the next line. If we use venetoclax-based therapy for the first line, we can switch to the BTK inhibitors, and the options there are, again, zanubrutinib and acalabrutinib for BTK inhibitors, and venetoclax in combination with a drug like obinutuzumab or rituximab in the relapse setting. Some patients will utilize the two lines of therapies that I mentioned, and they may still need something else. We now, in the past year, actually, we have access to two new drugs for patients who need treatment in third line. One is another BTK inhibitor that works differently compared to the ones that I just mentioned, and it's called pirtobrutinib. Pirtobrutinib is an extremely effective and extremely well-tolerated drug. It works in patients who have tried other BTK inhibitors and still have disease progression. And because it works differently on the BTK enzyme, even regardless of prior failure of the other BTK inhibitors, pirtobrutinib has shown activity. So it's a very important drug. And Dr. Kataime mentioned that this drug is now being studied in different settings, and we may see it in earlier lines of therapy in future. But right now, it's a great and very reliable option for patients who have received the other two classes before. A very exciting news that we, again, recently have a CAR-T therapy treatment available for our patients. It's called lysocaptagene maraloxil, or lysocell, or again, we just call it CAR-T. In the 32nd version of explaining CAR-T therapy, we take advantage of patients' own immune cells here. So immune cells called T cells are extremely strong and effective and capable. The problem is normally they don't fight the CLL cells as they should. So what happens here, we take those T cells out of patient's body in a procedure called apheresis. It's very similar to dialysis, basically. Then we use these T cells, and in the lab, we modify those T cells. After a few weeks, we put them back to patient's body, to their vein. It's just a simple infusion. We use some chemotherapy first, but this chemotherapy is not to treat CLL. It's part of that immunotherapy process. So 3 days of chemotherapy, then we give those T cells back to the patient, and those T cells are now able to recognize and fight and kill the CLL cells. And this is a very important treatment for different types of cancer, and we are very glad that finally we have it also available for patients with CLL, and it's FDA approved in the U.S. And my time is up, but I wanted to point out that there are a number of options. You can imagine there needs to be long and detailed discussions about pros and cons. Each patient is different in terms of having medical problems. We go through all the comorbidities. We look at their patient's history of heart disease, lung problems, bleeding problems, kidney issues, and we kind of weigh the risk and benefit of each approach against what's going on in terms of patient's history and patient's preferences. Some patients work and may not have time to go through that 8 weeks of weekly visit for a type of therapy. So this is just an introduction, but just a message here is that we are now officially in the era of targeted drugs. We don't use chemotherapy. We have very well-tolerated targeted drugs. Many of them are oral, and we are kind of trying to get away from even infusional drugs. And I'm sure Dr. Kataya will mention some of the exciting clinical trials that we have ongoing. And with that, I would stop here, and I'm happy to answer questions during the Q&A session.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Shadman. That was just a superb presentation. Wonderful. Just a wonderful presentation, actually, and you really set the stage for today's program, so I really want to thank you very much. And our next speaker is Dr. Adam Kataye, and Dr. Kataye is Associate Professor, Hematology and Medical Oncology, Department of Medicine, ICANN School of Medicine, Mount Sinai School Mount Sinai School, not Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. And Dr. Katai will be addressing clinical trial updates, how research increases your treatment options, guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments with technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes and quality of life concerns. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Katai.
Hi, everybody. Happy to be here to chat about all these things. Dr. Shadman had mentioned, I'm going to talk about some clinical trials that are currently underway that we're really excited about and explore why you should consider enrolling into a clinical trial and why it's so important. So let's start with that. So in my opinion, you should be thinking about a clinical trial to treat your cancer at every step of the way, even CLL, where we have all of these good therapies. And the reason why you really should be considering going on to a clinical trial is that we don't know everything. One of the main questions that we don't know in the world of CLL is if time-limited therapy with venetoclax or continuous BTK inhibitor therapy is the right way to go. There are a lot of trials that are evaluating this right now, but without clinical trials, there's no way for us as investigators, physicians, will ever be able to answer this question. So fundamentally, participating in clinical trials will help us answer this question to be able to know what best to treat future patients with. In addition, we're always trying to improve on patients' quality of life and toxicity. So for example, pirtobrutinib, the new non-covalent BTK inhibitor that Dr. Shadman talked about, is a super safe drug that looks like it's very effective. And the way that we know this is through clinical trials. And there are now new clinical trials that are being moved forward with pirtobrutinib to see if it better be served in the front line or the second line. We're not quite sure. And so I want to just highlight once again that, you know, even though we have made such great strides for the treatment of CLL with improvement in survival, decrease in toxicity compared to chemoimmunotherapy, participation in clinical trials is crucial. And another reason why you should consider clinical trial is that obviously cost is always a concern. And on clinical trials, very frequently, the drug cost is actually covered by the pharmaceutical company who is running the trial. So another reason to go on it. The last reason that I think that it's important to go on to clinical trials is generally the sense of, you know, helping the future of research. It's sort of a way to say, okay, I'm going to get these therapies in order to collect information that we need to make better informed questions in the future. And in the reality, for CLL, it's a very safe place to go onto a clinical trial. And the reason that is because our treatments are so effective, our frontline clinical trials, meaning that the trials that we use to treat treatment-naive disease, don't ever have a placebo or a sugar pill involved. You're always going to be randomized to what the current standard of care is, which we know works really well. And so once again, I just want to outline those four reasons why you should really consider clinical trials. Number one is that we're still trying to figure out what's best for patients, and the only way to do that is through a clinical trial. Number two is that a lot of the drugs that we're currently developing have good safety profiles, and we're trying to develop drugs that are safer and better for our patients. Number three is the general sense of contributing towards the future of treatment of cancer and improving patients in the future in terms of their cancer outcomes. Number four is going to be the free drug that you could potentially receive on a clinical trial. And I should have said five. And five is going to be, in general, CLL, for the most part, is you're going to be getting an active drug because our treatments work so well. So make sure that when you are discussing clinical trials with your treating physician, that you understand what drugs you're getting and why you're getting them. But overall, I want to encourage everybody to consider clinical trials, whether that be in the treatment-naive setting or in the relapse refractory setting. So on that note, I'm going to talk about a couple of the clinical trials that are really important, currently running and doing their analyses that we're looking forward to, and some new drugs that are on the horizon. So for one, I had mentioned before that the main question that we don't have the answer to in CLL is whether or not time-limited therapy works better than continuous therapy. So there are a number of trials that are currently underway that are asking this exact question. One of the trials that we are really excited to see is called the CLL17 study. And this was a randomized study that compared continuous ibrutinib versus time-limited ibrutinib plus venetoclax versus time-limited venetoclax plus obinutuzumab. So this is going to be the first trial that likely reads out where we are comparing all of our different treatment options, and we'll get a better idea about which of those treatment options might be the best to treat in the frontline setting. So we're really looking forward to having that trial read out because it'll give us a better understanding of how to treat our patients. Another concept that's currently being developed in various different trials is the concept of using three agents versus two agents versus one agent. And so right now we know that the BTK inhibitors, acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, work really well as continuous therapy. We know that venetoclax plus obinutuzumab or rituximab work really well as a time-limited therapy. And so the question becomes, what happens if we combine all three of those together or two of those together? Will we see better outcomes than using one by itself? So there are various studies that are combining acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib with venetoclax plus minus obinutuzumab with various different control arms, whether that be continuous therapy or time-limited therapy, and we're looking to see what the readouts for those trials might be. And so there you go. There's some flavors of various different things that are currently using what's currently approved in the frontline setting for patients with CLL. Getting back to pirtobrutinib, the non-covalent BTK inhibitor, this is now being moved forward from the relapse setting to the frontline setting. And there's a current trial that I believe has met accrual already that is comparing pirtobrutinib continuously versus ibrutinib continuously in the frontline CLL. And so we'll hopefully have a readout of that soon. And I think that trial is really interesting because as both me and Dr. Shadman alluded to, when we studied pirtobrutinib in the relapse setting, it really had a great safety profile. And so the question is not whether or not, as we move it forward to the frontline, if it continues to have that great safety profile, which I imagine it will, and whether or not it will be more effective than ibrutinib by itself. Moving on to some new agents that we're kind of excited about, and most of these are in the relapse refractory setting, are the bispecific antibodies and the BTK degraders. So bispecific antibodies are kind of like CAR T cell therapy, but it's an off-the-shelf drug, whereas CAR T cell therapy, you have to go through apheresis, taking out your T cells, genetically modifying them in the lab. The bispecific antibodies are currently ready and rearing to go without having to go through that process. And what it is an antibody that allows your T cells to target the cancer. And we have a couple of bispecific antibodies that are currently approved in other lymphomas like diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, follicular lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma. And it really showed some great promise in those spaces. And so we're excited to see how these bispecific antibodies might work in CLL, because now we do have that CAR T cell, a therapy that's now approved in CLL as well. Another thing that's currently being studied are the BTK degraders. So right now, the biggest area of unmet need for patients with CLL are those patients who progress after receiving a BTK inhibitor and venetoclax. And so these degraders, instead of just inhibiting the BTK kinase, the BTK protein, these ones literally degrade it, making it non-functional. And so these should work in patients who have progressed on normal BTK inhibitors. And there are multiple current trials ongoing evaluating this. There's all sorts of exciting things in CLL. There's all sorts of new CAR T cells that are coming out, CAR Ts combined with BTK inhibitors, and various other options that we're excited to see. And so I think that the future is bright in CLL, even brighter than it currently is, where, you know, I think that we'll be able to have an ample amount of therapies that are available to our patients that work really well and are not so toxic. So in my last few minutes, I'm going to talk about some guidelines to prepare for telehealth, some prepared questions, discussion of open notes, and quality of life concerns. So in terms of guidelines to prepare for telemedicine, so this is a sort of a topic that is not as relevant as it was during the COVID-19 pandemic, but I know that certain physicians are still able to do telemedicine visits. And so the number one, make sure that your doctor is okay doing telemedicine visits. There's a lot of rules and regulations around them. But if your doctor is still willing to do a telemedicine visit with you, I would make sure that you have a great webcam, a good microphone to speak to them, and make sure that you have your questions prepared before you get on the call, because I don't know about you, but when having Zoom meetings, at least even with colleagues, sometimes the conversation flow isn't the best. And oftentimes things get missed because people are not prepared prior to even entering into the meeting. And so from a patient perspective, that's why it's important to make sure you have your list of questions. Another thing to note for telehealth and telemedicine is that physicians' licenses don't normally cross states. And so make sure that you are careful with your telemedicine appointments and make sure that the doctor that you're speaking with is licensed in the state that you're physically located at. And that's something for you to chat with your doctor about as well. In terms of a prepared list of questions, I advise all my patients to prepare a list of questions before they come see me. And some of my patients come with, like, you know, 10 questions listed out to ask me and make sure that we cover during our visit. I think this is really important because for our patients who are coming in, we're just slamming them with information. And oftentimes, either being too overwhelmed by the information we're giving or just the stress of being in the doctor's office can oftentimes make you forget to ask the question that you're hoping to get. So make sure you do prepare a list of questions. And another thing I always advise my patients is try to bring someone else with you to all appointments. And if they can't come to all appointments, make sure they come with you to the very important ones. The very important ones mean when you are planning to discuss a treatment change with your physician, or you're planning to discuss some sort of scan or staging that is occurring with your physician. So make sure you bring an advocate for you so that way you both can kind of absorb all the information during the visit. So discussion of open notes. So if you all don't know what open notes is, the government passed a law a few years ago that basically said that all information is available to all patients, should be made available to all patients as soon as they're available to doctors. And so what this led to was basically whenever a scan, a result, a lab came through to a doctor's inbox on their electronic health record, it automatically went to patients. And so what that led to is that physicians weren't able to kind of discuss the result with their patients before actually viewing the result. And so I just want to make sure that you all are aware of this. I've had some patients who just strictly don't look at the results until they come see me or hear from me, so that is an approach that you can do. Other patients do get very anxious and want to see the results, which I totally understand. I'd be that kind of patient for sure. And so if you are going to look at your results, make sure that you come prepared to make sure that you are understanding what you're reading. And if you aren't understanding what you're reading, you should feel free to reach out your physician to make sure you discuss the results and either speak to the physician, a nurse, or a nurse practitioner to discuss them. But open notes are not a new thing. They're not going to go away anytime soon. And ultimately, it'll be up to you and your physician to discuss how you're going to handle being able to see that information before actually having that conversation with your doctor. The last thing to talk about is quality of life concerns. So one of the downsides to us moving to oral therapies as opposed to giving chemotherapy, which we see patients for, you know, every 3 weeks, is that sometimes the communication about toxicity gets a little bit lost in the swing of things. And so what I want to just highlight is that as you're getting any medication, if you are experiencing anything that you're worried about, you should discuss it with your oncologist or hematologist, because even the slightest thing can turn into a big thing. And so it gets easier with time. So as you're on these therapies for a long amount of time, you'll get a better understanding of what might be urgent versus non-urgent, but you should definitely consider talking to your physician about anything that you might experience that you're concerned might be related to your CLL or the treatment that you're receiving. And going back to the comments about the clinical trials, you know, at the end of the day, we are still trying to improve patients' quality of life. And the only way for us to really measure changes of quality of life is to follow patients forward in time. And the easiest place to do that is a clinical trial. And so I want to just encourage patients to enroll on clinical trials to try to improve our patients' quality of life. And I'm really happy to say that a lot of our therapies now, usually how I advise my patients is that they'll take a pill a day or twice a day, and they can go back to work typically. They typically enjoy their life. And usually what I advise my patients to is that if one medication doesn't work for you, we usually can find a medication that will work for you. So at this point, we have a lot of good options for patients with CLL, and I'm normally able to find something that works for my patients that not only improves their outcomes for their CLL, but also improves their quality of life. So on that note, I just want to say thanks for having me to discuss CLL, my favorite topic, and looking forward to our question and answer session.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cote. That was really wonderful, just a wonderful presentation, and so much packed into that presentation. And I know that there'll be lots of questions during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And I would now like to turn this program over to Dr. Brian Kaufman. Dr. Kaufman is retired. He's a physician. He's also master's in education, and he's co-founder, executive vice president, and chief medical officer of the CLL Society, and Inc. And Dr. Kaufman will be addressing CLL Society, free programs and services, and CLL SLL patient education toolkit. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kaufman.
Thank you for that kind introduction. For those who don't know us, CLL Society is an inclusive, patient-centric, physician-curated nonprofit that addresses the unmet needs of the CLL-SLL community through patient education, advocacy, support, and research. You never need to be alone at any time during your journey. We offer many free services to help you along the way. Our website, CLLSociety.org, offers valuable content in patient-friendly terms, from the most basic explanation of all the new terms you are learning, such as what is a lymphocyte or what does the spleen do, to our practical and sometimes life-saving COVID-19 action plan, the latest breaking news and research presented at the important conferences and in published journals. Today, you're getting updates on CLL-SLL. Supplement that with our interviews from the top researchers and coverage of the important latest findings and news that keeps you informed in the rapidly changing CLL treatment landscape. At least once a month, we have an educational or supportive webinar, podcast, Facebook Live event, or more. We offer no-cost virtual second opinions with world-class experts when you are facing a difficult decision. Just open CLLSociety.org and click on our expert access program to start the process of getting a consult. On our website, you can find 40-plus support groups that meet monthly through Zoom. Chances are good that you'll meet other patients and care partners who have experienced what you are going through. And our trained facilitators and other attendees, at a minimum, can always offer friendship and practical advice. If you prefer to meet one-on-one, we have trained peers we can connect you with for free one-on-one virtual sessions. We even offer a free, non-denominational chaplaincy service that has usually been more about supporting your emotional or existential rather than religious questions and challenges when battling CLL. We are constantly fighting for your rights with the FDA, the CDC, CMS, Congress, insurance companies, and the pharmaceutical industry through our public policy and advocacy team. And because CLL is not a solved problem, we are funding research to, among other things, improve outcome for all patients. Our motto is smart patients get smart care. You are already part of that smart patient movement by attending this session. CLL Society is here to augment your learning and support you at every stage of your CLL journey.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kaufman. It was just a wonderful, wonderful presentation, and CLL Society is such a wonderful resource to everybody on this call today. So if for those of you who have not taken advantage of the CLL Society, please do. It just offers wonderful resources for all of you, and you'll be hearing more about them. We're doing a four-part series in collaboration with the CLL Society, and you'll be hearing more about them with each program that we do. We have three more to go, so lots more to hear. Our next, I'm just going to say a few words about services of cancer care. So Cancer Care does offer a range of free programs and services, and they are for people living with cancer, all types of cancer, and all stages of cancer. So we offer programs for young adults and older adults, for people living with different types of cancers. And we also offer a number of different resources. We offer financial assistance and co-payment assistance, and financial assistance. We also offer a host of programs, online support groups, and also coping circles, resource navigation to help you find the resources that you need. And we also offer a host of services that would be very useful to all of you as well. And we also have a number of programs like this one that we offer regularly as well. And now, before that, we move on to the Q&A, I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
This is an interesting question. I'm going to ask Dr. Mazur this question. Can people with CLL donate organs, tissues, eyes upon their death?
That's a good question. I think a history of cancer would be a reason not to be eligible for that. So I think CLL is not an exception.
And another question, and this would be for Dr. Kate. I want to know the latest treatment of CLL. At what time? Just the latest treatment for CLL, which we've discussed, but Dr. Kate, if you just want to summarize that.
Yeah, I would say that the two new treatments that were most recently approved were pirtobrutinib, the non-covalent BTK inhibitor that was approved after two prior lines of therapy with both a BTK inhibitor and a BCL2 inhibitor. And then the other one is Lysocell or Lysocaptogene maraleucel, which is the CAR T-cell therapy that was approved for the same options. Another approval that was approved in outside of the United States with the combination of ibrutinib plus venetoclax, but that's not available here currently. But we do expect a combination like that to be hopefully approved sometime within the next year. So I would say those are probably the three newest approvals for patients with CLL.
Excellent. Thank you. And this is a question from one of our participants for Dr. Mazur. How likely are you to use the ibrutinib and venetoclax combination, and in which patients will you use it in?
Yeah, great question. I mean, as Dr. Kitai mentioned, the combination of ibrutinib plus venetoclax is not approved in the U.S., and from my knowledge, it's not expected to be approved. It is something that we could consider. It's on the what we call NCCN guidelines, so maybe in select patients you can decide to use it, but, you know, it's not considered the center of care in the U.S. To answer the kind of a question in general, and, you know, this is another form of time-limited therapy. So as I discussed, the currently approved time-limited or fixed-duration therapy that we have in U.S. and most other countries is combination of venetoclax with an infusional drug, obinutuzumab. So in some patients who are interested in that time-limited approach, but for any reason, there are many reasons for not liking or not wanting or having reactions to the infusion, that infusional drug will not be an option. So you could consider combining venetoclax and ibrutinib. So these are two oral drugs, two pills. And so So that would be the situation to think about using a combination of ibrutinib and venetoclax for a fixed duration. Now, there are other combinations combining venetoclax with other BTK inhibitors like acalabrutinib, and this combination may become available in near future for as a standard of care. And there are other combinations in clinical trials using zanubrutinib in combination with another drug very similar to venetoclax in terms of the way they work. But again, in some other countries, and I know in Europe and in Canada, the combination of ibrutinib and venetoclax is approved. And again, could be used in patients who are interested in time-limited, but they don't want infusional drug, or they've tried infusional drug and they had a major reaction to it, or for any reason that physician and patient decide that they want to go with an all-oral regimen, that they can consider ibrutinib and venetoclax.
Thank you. Thanks. A question that we have here, the number of people asking if they've missed the presentation will be recorded or if they'd like to listen to it again. And indeed, of course, you can listen to it again. This program is recorded and it is available as a podcast, and it should be up within a couple of days after the program occurs. And so you'll all be able to listen to it in a few days. So just to be aware of that, it will be on the Cancer Care website and probably on the CLL website as well. Questions? Let's see. Lots of questions here. This is a question. This is a question then for Dr. Katai. Do you think there's any benefit to early treatment for high-risk CLL?
Great question. Right now, we don't have any evidence that early treatment for patients with high-risk CLL does affect outcomes. So there was a recently published study of ibrutinib versus placebo for patients with high-risk CLL, and ultimately what we found was that the overall survival was the same. We're still waiting for some longer-term follow-up from it, but so far the overall survival is the same, and the ibrutinib just added some more toxicity. And so that was not a positive trial. And then there's currently a study run through one of our cooperative groups called SWOG. It's the EVOLVE study that's studying the combination of venetoclax plus obinutuzumab as a time-limited therapy for patients with high-risk disease. And so we will hopefully have the answer to that question, at least in the form of venetoclax plus obinutuzumab sometime in the next few years. And so if somebody has high-risk disease with early-stage CLL, I would encourage them to try to seek out that trial to participate. It's a great trial.
Excellent. And a question for Dr. Messer. Can you better explain the staging system for CLL?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, in cancer, we always think about staging, and that's, of course, important. As I mentioned, in CLL, being a different type of disease, we don't use the typical staging system that we use for diseases like colon cancer, breast cancer, and things like that. So there are two clinical staging systems that we use. One is RAI, R-A-I. That's after Dr. Conti Rai, who's one of the pioneers in CLL research, and that system is mainly used in the U.S. And there's a Binet staging system, and that's named after Dr. Binet, another prominent CLL physician. So basically, for RAI staging system, it goes from a stage 0 to 4, and it looks at different variables, like, you know, if patients have elevated lymphocyte count in their blood, so if their white blood count is elevated, whether or not they have large lymph nodes, whether or not they have large liver or spleen, whether or not they have anemia or or if they have a low platelet count. And basically, you know, we kind of give a score to each of these and come up with a stage from 0 to 4. So when we talk about CLL stage 0, it means that there's a patient who has CLL, but it's only in form of having elevated white blood count or lymphocyte count, and they don't have lymph nodes that we can kind of palpate on physical exam, and they don't have anemia and thrombocytopenia. And as they develop those other kind of problems, the stage goes up from 1 to 4. And we usually consider treatment for patients definitely with stage 3 or 4, and sometimes in stages 2 or 1 if they have symptoms. As I said, I mean, this is something we use, and, you know, mainly in clinical trials to get an idea and kind of make sure that we have an understanding of the disease presentation. But what's more relevant in CLL and more important than actual staging is what is happening at the level of the genome and the chromosomes, and those would be the chromosome changes and mutations that patients may have within their cancer cells, and that's why we talk about the FISH studies and the mutation studies.
Well, thank you so much. And question for Dr. Cattay about masking, just masking two question marks. So could you comment on that?
Yeah, you know, it's a really great question. I think that masking for patients with CLL, we weren't recommending it prior to the COVID pandemic. In general, prior to COVID pandemic, we would just recommend, you know, good hand washing, don't touch your face, try to avoid people who are symptomatic with symptoms for upper respiratory tract infections. In general, I've moved back to that recommendation for the most part. I think ultimately it is a personal decision. A simple surgical mask likely doesn't decrease your risk of getting COVID or other upper respiratory tract infections, unless you're in a room where everybody's masking and there's open air and ventilation. But if you're on an airline and you're trying to reduce your risk for getting upper respiratory tract infections, you can use an N95 mask. If you're in a crowded space, you can use an N95 mask. But ultimately, the data to support the use of masking is not really there right now. Ultimately, I think that it's a personal decision if you're going to want to use a surgical mask. But if you are going to mask, the recommendation would be to use an N95 because that would probably be the most effective way to prevent you from getting an upper respiratory tract infection. Unfortunately, I think because the data is not there, if you were to ask everybody who treats CLL or hematologic malignancies the same exact question, we probably would give you a slightly different answer.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question from one of our participants, Dr. Mazia. I've had CLL for 2 years and am on watch and wait. Fatigue is my biggest problem. I am a pastor and work full time. Will zanubrutinib help with fatigue?
I think this is a great question, and I would make it more general. If we believe that fatigue is related to CLL or SLL, and number one, it means that that disease needs to be treated. So, and number two, any treatment that we mentioned here would help with the fatigue as long as it's related to CLL. Remember, fatigue is a very general symptom. There are many factors that could really cause fatigue or contribute. I always tell patients that whatever percentage of the fatigue that's related to CLL, by starting treatment, that could be zanubrutinib, acalabrutinib, venetoclax, obinutuzumab, pirtobrutinib, any of the effective CLL treatments, yes, that percentage of the fatigue will be gone because these treatments are effective. Now, in one person, that could be 90% of the fatigue explained by CLL. In other person, it could be the sleep apnea and, you know, many other factors that one needs to rule out. So, yes, the CLL-related fatigue will go away with not just zanubrutinib, with any treatment that we offer.
Excellent. Thank you. In terms of the takeaways, I'd like each of our speakers to comment on the takeaway from today's program. So I'll start with Dr. Shadman and then Dr. Cattay. Dr. Shadman?
Yes, I'm happy to. And, you know, in my 30 seconds, since we're almost done with our time, I just wanted to remind patients that we now have monoclonal antibodies against COVID-19 that are recently approved, or another one will soon be approved. And these are drugs that could be used, for example, for patients who are, you know, going to attend an event or travel and they're worried about their COVID-19 risk and complications. We could, sometimes we can offer them these antibodies that provide some kind of temporary protection. So discuss this with your physicians. And again, there are new drugs that are now either available or soon will be available. And I would just, I wanted to highlight that since we didn't discuss. I just have a discussion with your physician about those antibodies.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Kay?
Yeah, so thanks again for having me. I'll just end this by saying that over the last 10 years, we really have revolutionized the way that we treat CLL, with patients living longer, more fuller, with less side effects lives. And so at the end of the day, I think we've made some great strides with CLL, but there's a lot more to be done. It's really a great time. I should say great time. That's not the right word I'm saying here. It's been really great for our patients to have so many good options and allowing them to, you know, as I said, live fuller, better, longer lives.
Oh, thank you so much. I actually want to thank all of our speakers. You've been really phenomenal. I also want to thank all of our participants for really just being so amazing in terms of, you know, just the way that you've participated in today's call and the questions you've asked. So many wonderful questions, really. And we could go on all afternoon, probably. There's so many questions, actually. And so I just want to thank everyone for your participation. I also want to thank the CLL Society for being such a wonderful collaborating organization. And again, we will be working with them on three more programs, so stay tuned. Just really look forward to working with everybody going forward on these programs. Again, I just want to remind everybody that, of course, this is a one-hour program, and as such, of course, only allows us to cover some information, not everything. We do recommend, of course, that you, for those of you who either asked a question or have a question yet to ask or in queue to ask a question, we want you to take your questions back to Treating Healthcare team, even if you asked a question here, just because we want to be sure they know you the best. They have your records in front of them, your medical records, and they're basically able to, of course, customize your answers to your needs. And ask your questions over and over again. That's really important. And keep asking your questions. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.